English and published in bilingual editions. On Monday, March 18th at 7 o'clock p.m., the WORT Access Hour will be presenting a special program, Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish, discussing the ongoing process of translations, its similarities and differences, its joys and pitfalls. Host James P. Roberts and guest Diego Alegría will share examples of their favorite poets and how reading them has affected their own poetry. That's Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish on Monday, March 18th at 7 o'clock p.m. on the Access Hour.
It's the third Friday of the month, a little past 11. Time for another installment of Fiction Jones and part 10 of Mary Shelley's 1818 novel Frankenstein. Coming up right after Lars von Trier's introduction to Europa.
You will now listen to my voice. My voice will help you and guide you still deeper into Europa. Every time you hear my voice, with every word and every number, you will enter a still deeper lair, open, relaxed, and receptive. I shall now count from 1 to 10. On the count of 10, you will be in Europa. I say 1. And as you focus your attention entirely on my voice, you will slowly begin to relax. 2. Your hands and your fingers are getting warmer and heavier. 3. The warmth is spreading through your arms, to your shoulders and your neck. 4. Your feet and your legs get heavier. 5. The warmth is spreading to the whole of your body. On 6, I want you to go deeper. I say 6. And the whole of your relaxed body is slowly beginning to sink. 7. You go deeper and deeper and deeper. 8. On every breath you take, you go deeper. 9. You are floating. On the mental count of 10, you will be in Europa. Be there at 10. I say 10. You are listening to the noise of rain beating against a large metal drum. Go closer. There's a fence, and you have to stop. You are walking across the rail yard, and you've been traveling by train from Bremerhaven, and before that, on a ship from New York. You are in Germany. The year is 1945.
You are in Germany, but the year is 1818 in Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein. What was happening in 1818? The dandy horse was invented, the Laufmaschine, or the bicycle, in Germany. The first Seminole Wars started by Andrew Jackson when he invaded Florida, but then later condemned by President James Monroe, who convened a cabinet meeting to disavow the action, but was defeated by Secretary of State John Quincy Adams. And in 1818, the Christmas carol, Silent Night, was set to music in Austria. But in our 1818, in Germany, a young and ambitious Dr. Frankenstein has created a living being from parts of the dead. He flees from it in horror when it comes alive. The bereft creature roams homeless, friendless, through the German countryside. He finds a hiding place next to a poor cottage. He learns to read and speak. by observing a peasant family, the De Lacys. But when he finally overcomes his fear and is overwhelmed by his loneliness, he shows himself as a friend. He's violently attacked, driven away. All of this is being recounted now to Dr. Frankenstein by the creature. His story now brings us to the creature's accidental encounter with a small boy named William, who happens to be Victor Frankenstein's brother. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, coming up next on Fiction Jones. As the night advanced, a fierce wind arose from the woods and quickly dispersed the clouds that had loitered in the heavens. A blast tore along like a mighty avalanche and produced a kind of insanity in my spirits that burst all bounds of reason and reflection. I lighted the dry branch of a tree and I danced with fury around the devoted cottage, my eyes still fixed on the western horizon, the edge of which the moon nearly touched. A part of its orb was at length hid, and I waved my brand. It sunk, and with a loud scream I fired the straw, the heath, the bushes, which I had collected, and the wind fanned the fire, and the cottage was quickly enveloped by the flames, which clung to it and licked it with their forked and destroying tongues. As soon as I was convinced that no assistance could save any part of the habitation, I quitted the scene and sought for refuge in the woods. And now, with the world before me, whither should I bend my steps? I resolved to fly far from the scene of my misfortunes, but to me, hated and despised, every country must be equally horrible. At length, the thought of you crossed my mind. I'd learned from your papers that you were my father, my creator. And to whom could I apply with more fitness than to him who had given me life? Among the lessons that Felix had bestowed upon Safij's geography had not been omitted. I had learned from these that the relative situations of the different countries of the earth had in part involved Geneva as the name of your native town, and towards this place I resolved to proceed. But how was I to direct myself? I knew that I must travel in a southwesterly direction to reach my destination, but the sun was my only guide. I did not know the names of the towns that I was to pass through, nor could I ask information from a single human being. But I did not despair. From you only could I hope for succor, although towards you I felt no sentiment but that of hatred. Unfeeling, heartless creator, you had endowed me with perceptions and passions and then cast me abroad, an object for the scorn and horror of mankind. But on you only had I any claim for pity and redress, and from you I determined to seek that justice which I vainly attempted to gain from any other being that wore the human form. My travels were long, and the sufferings I endured intense. It was late in autumn when I quitted the district where I had so long resided. I traveled only at night, fearful of encountering the visage of a human being. Nature decayed around me, and the sun became heartless. Rain and snow poured around me. Mighty rivers were frozen. The surface of the earth was hard and chill and bare, and I found no shelter. O earth, how often did I imprecate curses on the cause of my being? The mildness of my nature had fled, and all within me was turned to gall and bitterness. The nearer I approached your habitation, the more deeply did I feel the spirit of revenge enkindled in my heart. Snow fell. The waters were hardened, but I rested not. A few incidents now and then directed me, and I possessed a map of the country, but I often wandered wide from my path. The agony of my feelings allowed me no respite. No incident occurred from which my rage and misery could not extract its food. But a circumstance that happened when I arrived on the confines of Switzerland, when the sun had recovered its warmth and the air again began to look green, confirmed in a special manner the bitterness, the horror of my feelings. I generally rested during the day and traveled only when I was secured by night from the view of man. One morning, however, finding that my path lay through a deep wood, I ventured to continue my journey after the sun had risen. The day, which was one of the first of spring, cheered even me by the loveliness of its sunshine and the balminess of the air. I felt emotions of gentleness and pleasure that had long appeared dead, revive within me. Half surprised by the novelty of these sensations, I allowed myself to be borne away by them, and, forgetting my solitude and deformity, dared to be happy. Soft tears again bedewed my cheeks, and I even raised my humid eyes with thankfulness towards the blessed sun which bestowed such joy upon me. I continued to wind among the paths of the wood until I came to its boundary, which was skirted by deep and rapid rivers, into which many of the trees bent their branches, now budding with fresh spring. Here I paused, not exactly knowing what path to pursue, when I heard the sound of voices that induced me to conceal myself under the shade of a cypress. I was scarcely hid when a young girl came running towards the spot where I was concealed, laughing as if she ran from someone in sport. She continued her course along the precipitous sides of the river when suddenly her foot slipped and she fell into the rapid stream. I rushed from my hiding place and with extreme labor from the force of the current saved her and dragged her to shore. She was senseless, and I endeavored by every means in my power to restore animation, when I was suddenly interrupted by the approach of a rustic, who was probably the person from whom she had playfully fled. On seeing me, he darted towards me, and, tearing the girl from my arms, hastened towards the deeper parts of the wood. I followed speedily, I hardly knew why, but when the man saw me, drawing near, he aimed a gun, which he carried at my body, and fired. I sunk to the ground, and my injurer, with increased swiftness, escaped into the wood. This was then the reward of my benevolence. I had saved a human being from destruction, and as recompense, I now writhed under the miserable pain of a wound, which shattered the flesh and bone. The feelings of kindness and gentleness which I had entertained but just a few moments before gave place to hellish rage, gnashing of teeth. Inflamed by pain, I vowed eternal hatred and vengeance to all mankind. But the agony of my wound overcame me. My pulses paused. I fainted. For some weeks, I led a miserable life in the woods, endeavoring to cure the wound which I had received. The ball had entered my shoulder, and I knew not whether it had remained there or passed through. And I knew not whether it had been there at any length of time, and at any rate, I had no means of extracting it. My sufferings were augmented also by the oppressive sense of the injustice and the ingratitude of their infliction. My daily vows rose for revenge, a deep and deadly revenge, such as would alone compensate for the outrages and the anguish that I had endured. After some weeks, my wound healed, and I continued my journey. The labors I endured were no longer to be alleviated by the bright sun or the gentle breezes of spring. All joy was but a mockery, which insulted my desolate state and made me feel more painfully that I was not made for the enjoyment of pleasure. But my toils now drew near a close, and 2 months from this time I reached the environs of Geneva. It was evening when I arrived, and I retired to a hiding place among the fields that surrounded it to meditate in what manner I should apply to you. I was oppressed by fatigue and hunger, and far too unhappy to enjoy the gentle breezes of evening or the prospect of the sun setting behind the stupendous mountains of Jura. At this time, a slight sleep relieved me from the pain of reflection, which was disturbed by the approach of a beautiful child who came running into the recess I had chosen with all the sportiveness of infancy. Suddenly, as I gazed on him, an idea seized me that this little creature was unprejudiced and had lived too short a time to have imbibed a horror of deformity. If, therefore, I could seize him and educate him as my companion and friend, I should not be so desolate in this peopled earth. Urged by this impulse, I seized on the boy as he passed and drew him towards me. As he beheld my form, he placed his hands before his eyes and uttered a shrill scream. I drew his hand forcibly from his face and I said, "Child, what is the meaning of this? I do not intend to hurt you. Listen to me." He struggled violently. "Let me go," he cried. "Monster, ugly wretch, you wish to eat me, tear me to pieces. You are an ogre. Let me go, or I will tell my papa." "Boy, you will never see your father again. You must come with me." "Hideous monster, let me go. My papa is a syndic. He's M. Frankenstein. He will punish you. You dare not keep me." "Frankenstein? You belong then to my enemy? To him towards whom I have sworn eternal revenge? You shall be my first victim." The child still struggled and loaded me with epithets which carried despair to my heart. I grasped his throat to silence him, and in a moment he lay dead at my feet. I gazed on my victim. My heart swelled with exultation, hellish triumph. Clapping my hands, I exclaimed, "I too can create desolation. My enemy's not impregnable. This death will carry despair to him, and 1,000 other miseries shall torment and destroy him." As I fixed my eyes on the child, I saw something glittering on his breast. I took it. It was a portrait of a most lovely woman. In spite of my malignity, it softened and attracted me. For a few moments I gazed with delight on her dark eyes, fringed by deep lashes, her lovely lips. But presently my rage returned. I remembered that I was forever deprived of the delights that such beautiful creatures could bestow, and that she whose resemblance I contemplated would, in regarding me, have changed that air of divine benignity to one expressive of disgust and affright. Can you wonder that such thoughts transported me with rage? I only wonder that at that moment, instead of venting my sensations in exclamations of agony, I did not rush among mankind and perish in the attempt to destroy them. While I was overcome by these feelings, I left the spot where I had committed the murder and was seeking a more secluded hiding place when I perceived a woman passing near me. She was young, not indeed so beautiful as her whose portrait I had held, but of an agreeable aspect, and blooming in the loveliness of youth and health. Here, I thought, is one of those whose smiles are bestowed on all but me. She shall not escape, thanks to the lessons of Felix and the sanguinary laws of man I've learned how to work mischief. I approached her unperceived, placed the portrait securely in one of the folds of her dress. For some days, I haunted the spot where these scenes had taken place. Sometimes wishing to see you, sometimes resolved to quit the world and its miseries forever. At length, I wandered towards these mountains and have ranged through their immense recesses, consumed by a burning passion which you alone can gratify. We may not part until you have promised to comply with my requisition. I am alone and miserable. Man will not associate with me. But one as deformed and horrible as myself would not deny herself to me. My companion must be of the same species, and you have the same defects to give her. This being you must create. Frankenstein Chapter 9. The being finished speaking and fixed his looks upon me in expectation of a reply. But I was bewildered, I was perplexed. I was unable to arrange my ideas sufficiently to understand the full extent of his proposition. You must create a female for me with whom I can live in the interchange of those sympathies necessary for my being. This alone you can do, and I demand it of you as a right which you must not refuse. The latter part of his tale had kindled anew in me the anger that had died away while he narrated his peaceful life among the cottagers, and as he said this, I could no longer suppress the rage that burned within me. "I do refuse it," I replied, "and no torture shall ever extort a consent from me. You may render me the most miserable of men, but you shall never make me base in my own eyes. Shall I create another like you yourself, whose joint wickedness might desolate the world? Begone! I've answered you. You may torture me, but I will never consent." "You are in the wrong," replied the fiend, "and I, instead of it threatening, I'm content to reason with you. I am malicious because I am miserable. Am I not shunned and hated by all of mankind? You, my creator, would tear me to pieces and triumph. Remember that, and tell me why I should pity man more than he pities me. You would not call it murder if you could precipitate me into one of these ice rifts, destroy my frame, the work of your own hands. Shall I respect man when he contempts me? Let him live with me in the interchange of kindness instead of injury. I would bestow every benefit upon him with tears of gratitude at his acceptance, but that cannot be. The human senses are insurmountable to barriers to our union. Yet mine shall not be the submission of abject slavery. I will revenge my injuries. If I cannot inspire love, I will cause fear, and chiefly towards you, my archenemy, because my creator do I swear inextinguishable hatred. Have a care. I will work at your destruction, nor finish until I desolate your heart, so that you curse the hour of your birth. A fiendish rage animated him as he said this. His face was wrinkled into contortions, too horrible for human eyes to behold. But presently he calmed himself and proceeded. I intended to reason. This passion is detrimental to me, for you do not reflect that you are the cause of its excess. If any being felt emotions of benevolence towards me, I should return then 100 and 100-fold. For that one creature's sake, I would make peace with the whole kind. But I now indulge in dreams of bliss that cannot be realized. What I ask of you is reasonable. It's moderate. I demand a creature of another sex, but as hideous as myself. The gratification is small, but it is all that I can receive, and it shall content me. It is true we shall be monsters and cut off from the world, but on that account we shall be more attached to one another. Our lives will not be happy, but they will be harmless, free from the misery I now feel. Oh, my Creator, make me happy. Let me feel gratitude towards you for one benefit. Let me see that I excite the sympathy of some existing thing. Don't deny me my request. I was moved. I shuddered when I thought of the possible consequences of my consent, but I felt that there was some justice in his argument. His tale and the feelings he now expressed proved him to be a creature of fine sensations, and did I not, as his maker, owe him all the portion of happiness that it was in my power to bestow? He saw my change of feeling and continued, "If you consent, neither you nor any other human being shall ever see us again. I will go to the vast wilds of South America. My food is not that of man. I do not destroy the lamb and the kid, so to glut my appetite. Acorns, berries afford me sufficient nourishment. My companion will be of the same nature as myself, and will be content with the same fare. We shall make our bed of dried leaves. The sun will shine on us as on man, and will ripen our food. The picture I present to you is peaceful, is human. You must feel that you could deny it only in the wantonness of power and cruelty. Pitiless if you have been towards me, I now see compassion in your eyes. Let me seize the favorable moment, persuade you to promise what I so ardently desire." "You propose," replied I, "to fly from the habitations of man, to dwell in those wilds where the beasts of the field will be your only companions? How can you, who long for the love and sympathy of man, persevere in this exile? You will return and again seek their kindness, and you will meet with their detestation. Your evil passions will be renewed again, and you will then have a companion to aid you in the task of destruction. This may not be. Cease to argue the point. I cannot consent." "How inconstant are your feelings! But a moment ago you were moved by my representations. Why do you again harden yourself to my complaints? I swear to you, by the earth which I inhabit, and by you that made me, that with the companion you bestow, I will quit the neighborhood of man, and dwell, as it may chance, in the most savage of places. My evil passions will have fled, for I shall be met with sympathy. My life will flow quietly away, and in my dying moments I shall not curse my Maker." His words had a strange effect on me. I compassionated him, and sometimes felt a wish to console him. But when I looked upon him, when I saw the filthy mass that moved and talked, my heart sickened. My feelings were altered to those of horror and hatred. I tried to stifle these sensations. I thought that as I could not sympathize with him, I had no right to withhold from him the small portion of happiness which was yet in my power to bestow. "You swear," I said, "to be harmless, but have you not already shown a degree of malice that should reasonably make me distrust you? May not even this be a feint that will increase your triumph by affording a wider scope for your revenge? How is this? I thought I had moved your compassion, and yet you still refuse to bestow on me the only benefit that can soften my heart and render me harmless. If I have no ties and no affections, hatred and vice must be my portion. The love of another will destroy the cause of my crimes, and I shall become a thing of whose existence every one will be ignorant. My vices are the children of a forced solitude that I abhor, and my virtues will necessarily arise when I live in communion with an equal. I shall feel the affections of a sensitive being and become linked to the chain of existence and events from which I am now excluded." I paused some time to reflect on all he had related and the various arguments which he had employed. I thought of the promise of virtues which he had displayed on the opening of his existence, and the subsequent blight of all kindly feeling by the loathing and the scorn which his protectors had manifested towards him. His power and threats were not omitted in my calculations. A creature who could exist in the ice caves of the glaciers and hide himself from pursuit among the ridges of inaccessible precipices was a being possessed of faculties that it would be vain to cope with. After a long pause of reflection, I concluded that the justice due both to him and my fellow creatures demanded of me that I should comply with his request. Turning to him, therefore, I said, I consent to your demand, on your solemn oath to quit Europe forever, and every other place in the neighborhood of man, as soon as I shall deliver into your hands a female who will accompany you in your exile. I swear, he cried, by the sun, by the blue sky of heaven, that if you grant my prayer, while they exist, you shall never behold me again, never. Depart to your home and commence your labors. I shall watch their progress with unutterable anxiety, and fear not, but that when you are ready, I shall appear. Saying this, he suddenly quitted me, fearful, perhaps, of any change in my sentiments. I saw him descend the mountain with greater speed than the flight of an eagle, and quickly lost him among the undulations of the seas of ice. His tail had occupied the whole day, and the sun was upon the verge of the horizon when he departed. I knew that I ought to hasten my descent towards the valley, and as soon as I should be accompanied in darkness. But my heart was heavy, and my steps slow. The labor of winding among the little paths of the mountains and fixing my feet firmly as I advanced perplexed me, occupied me as I was by the emotions which the occurrences of the day had produced. Night was far advanced when I came to the halfway resting place and seated myself beside the fountain. The stars shone at intervals as the clouds passed from one to another, and the dark pines rose before me, and every here and there a broken tree lay on the ground. It was a scene of wonderful solemnity and stirred strange thoughts within me. I wept bitterly. Clasping my hands in agony, I exclaimed, "Stars and clouds and winds, ye are all about to mock me. If ye really pity me, crush sensation and memory, let me become as naught. But if not, depart. Depart and leave me in darkness." These were wild, miserable thoughts, but I cannot describe to you how the eternal twinkling of the stars weighed upon me, and how I listened to every blast of wind as if it were a dull, ugly siroc on its way to consume me. Morning dawned before I arrived at the village of Chamonix, but my presence, so haggard and strange, hardly calmed the fears of my family, who had waited the whole night in anxious expectation of my return. The following day we returned to Geneva. The intention of my father in coming had been to divert my mind and to restore me to my lost tranquility, but the medicine had been fatal. And unable to account for the excess of misery I appeared to suffer, he hastened to return home, hoping the quiet and monotony of a domestic life would by degrees alleviate my sufferings from whatsoever cause they might spring. For myself, I was passive in all their arrangements, and the gentle affection of my beloved Elizabeth was inadequate to draw me from the depths of my despair. The promise I had made to the Damon weighed upon my mind, like Dante's iron cowl on the heads of the hellish hypocrites. All pleasures of earth and sky passed before me like a dream, and that thought only had to me the reality of life. Can you wonder that sometimes a kind of insanity possessed me, or that I saw continually about me a multitude of filthy animals inflicting on me incessant torture that often extorted screams, bitter groans? By degrees, however, these feelings became calmed. I entered again into the everyday scene of life, if not with interest, at least with some degree of tranquility.
secrets travel, I start to believe if I were to leave, pink sky, the man shakes his hands held high. Cruise me, yacht, cruise me, babe. A blonde leaf beyond, beyond, beyond. Blow me down, no return.
Frankenstein, Volume 3, Chapter 1. Day after day, week after week passed away on my return to Geneva, and I could not collect the courage to recommence my work. I feared the vengeance of the disappointed fiend, yet I was unable to overcome my repugnance to the task which was enjoyed me. I found that I could not compose a female without again devoting several months to profound study and laborious disquisition. I had heard of some discoveries having been made by an English philosopher, the knowledge of which was material to my success, and I sometimes thought of obtaining my father's consent to visit England for this purpose, but I clung to every pretense of delay, and I could not resolve to interrupt my returning tranquility. And that was part 10 of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I hope you can join me next Friday at 11 p.m. for part 11. We're here every third, fourth, and fifth Friday from 11 to 12 midnight. Hope you have a wonderful week. Coming up next is oh, okay. The Radio Hour, of course. Stay tuned for that and all the other great programming here on your listener sponsored WORT. See you later.
This is Brian from Spafford, and you're listening to the XL290 Live Music Radio Hour on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Mineral Point Opera House, presenting Rucksack Revolution on Saturday, March 16th at 7:30 p.m. Rucksack Revolution features Adam Gruhl of Horseshoes and Hand Grenades and Sarah Voss from Dead Horses, whose collaboration features tight harmonies, introspective lyricism, and soaring melodies. More information and tickets are available at mineralpointoperahouse.org.
Who took the bomb? Madison Roller Derby's 19th season continues with Game 4 on Saturday, March 16th at 5 p.m. in the arena at Alliant Energy Center in Madison. This month's game is Team Unicorn versus Wisconsin United Roller Derby, who are an all-gender flat-track roller derby league. Doors at 5 p.m., skates hit the track at 6 p.m. Tickets can be purchased online at madisonrollerderby.org/tickets or at the door. Madison Roller Derby's fourth game of the season is Saturday, March 16th at 5 p.m. at the arena at Alliant Energy Center in Madison. Supporting community nonprofits since 1975, this is WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.
Thank you.